ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 9th of April. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. A fragile ceasefire in Iran could be on the brink of collapse less than 24 hours after it came into effect. Iran is claiming Israel is breaching the truce deal by continuing attacks against Hezbollah in Lebanon. But the US and Israel say that was never part of the agreement. Correspondent Alison Horn reports from Jerusalem.
A wave of Israeli strikes pounding the Lebanese capital, Beirut. There's chaos on the streets as rescuers rush in to help the wounded and dig through the rubble. Israel says it launched 100 different attacks on the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah in a 10-minute window. Lebanese authorities estimate at least 250 people were killed, 1,000 more injured, and political leaders have labelled it a massacre and barbaric. Israel's Defence Minister Israel Katz says the war in Lebanon is not part of the two-week ceasefire agreement reached between Israel, the United States and Iran.
We insisted on separating the arenas between Iran and Lebanon in order to change the reality in Lebanon and to remove threats from the residents in the north.
But Iran and Pakistan, which brokered the deal, say Lebanon is covered by the fragile truce, even though the US President Donald Trump has told American media he doesn't agree. Iran is now warning it'll withdraw from any ceasefire agreement if the attacks on Lebanon continue. Tehran's ambassador to the United Nations, Ali Bahraini, threatening Iran's forces are primed to resume the conflict.
We are not putting any trust on the other side, so our military forces are keeping their preparedness, they are keeping their vigilance to react to any scenario. But meanwhile, we will go for negotiations to see how serious the other side is.
Those negotiations are supposed to be held in Islamabad on Friday, a chance for all sides to discuss each other's demands for a permanent peace plan, including operations for the Strait of Hormuz. The vital shipping lane was meant to reopen as part of the two-week truce deal, but it was blocked again on Wednesday afternoon by Iran in response to what it calls Israel's ceasefire breach in Lebanon. Earlier US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Washington was confident ships would soon be transiting the waterway.
We're going to make sure Iran complies with this ceasefire and then ultimately comes to the table and makes a deal. So we'll stay put, stay ready, stay vigilant. As far as the strait, you saw the initial agreement that was struck, which is Iran's letting ships go through. So there'll be that will be happening. They will be sailing.
But it's unclear when that will happen and whether America will have to pressure Israel to stop its attacks in Lebanon to make a final deal. This is Alison Horn in Jerusalem reporting for AM.
The ABC's America's editor John Lyons is in Washington. He joined me a short time ago. John, Israel says it's not part of this agreement. The White House appears to be backing that position, but there's pressure from world leaders for that to change. Could this jeopardise the ceasefire?
Well, it's certainly already a fragile situation with the ceasefire, and the details were not really clearly stipulated. There was crossed wires or confusion about Iran had a 10-point plan. Now, President Trump is saying that wasn't the basis on which the ceasefire was made. And now Iran is saying that because Israel is in fact escalating its bombing of Beirut and other parts, that therefore the ceasefire has been broken, and there are reports now that they have closed off again the Strait of Hormuz. And so we really don't know. The key issue will be whether President Trump is prepared to put pressure on Israel to say that either we have a ceasefire for 2 weeks across the region, or we don't, or it endangers the ceasefire with Iran.
Donald Trump threatened the end of a civilization yesterday before reaching the deal at the 11th hour. The reaction to that statement is still being felt. In Australia, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has described that language as not appropriate. What's the reaction been in the US?
It's been very strong, and there has been a backlash against the president for using that sort of language of wiping out civilizations or a civilization. Megyn Kelly, who's a former Fox presenter, significant influencer here in America, more than 4 million YouTube subscribers, she said President Trump's negotiating tactic is to kill an entire country full of civilians, men, women and children. And she's now questioned how good a negotiator he really is, and she says if he has to threaten a bunch of war crimes to get what he wants. But it's significant, too, that Republicans now are starting to push back publicly, which is quite new. For example, the Republican from Alaska, Lisa Murkowski, said the president's threat could not be excused away as an attempt to gain leverage in negotiations with Iran. She said this type of rhetoric is an affront to the ideals that the nation has sought to uphold and promote around the world for nearly 250 years. And another Republican from Wisconsin, Senator Ron Johnson, he said, I do not want to see us start blowing up civilian infrastructure. We are not at war with the Iranian people. We're trying to liberate them. So it's interesting now that it's the Republicans who are starting to come out. And I think they realize they're in trouble with the midterms in November. They're now trying to distance themselves from President Trump.
John Lyons there in Washington. Dr. Charles Kupchan is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University. Professor Kupchan, will this ceasefire last?
I'm not sure it started. It is very shaky. Missiles and drones continue to fly in the region. The Strait of Hormuz, as we speak, appears to have been closed after being reopened because Iran objects to continued Israeli strikes against Lebanon. And if you look at where the Iranians are and where the U.S. is on the key points that will be discussed in Pakistan, the two sides are very, very far apart. So, you know, it's a start. We can all breathe a guarded sigh of relief that a massive air campaign did not start last night. But at this point, I would say there still is no clear light at the end of the tunnel.
Both sides are claiming victory. How will it be received by both the Iranian people and the U.S. people?
Well, you know, both sides in some ways have to claim victory because it's an important part of retaining diplomatic leverage and also popular support. But the flip side of that is that if you have Iran claiming victory and putting out a set of demands, such as control over the Strait of Hormuz, the complete pulling down of sanctions and tariffs, a reparations deal that the international community rebuilds from the damage done, a complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from the Persian Gulf area. Those are showstoppers. Those are non-starters. And then Donald Trump, if he's claiming victory, he's got to be able to deliver no nuclear enrichment, no serious stockpile of ballistic missiles, no more support for proxies. So right now, the U.S. position and the Iranian position are completely at odds. And as a consequence of that, one has to look at these negotiations that are about to begin with a significant level of skepticism.
If this ceasefire holds, how soon could we see movement of ships through that channel?
Well, I think we need to see movement of ships through that channel immediately. In fact, I would surmise that if tankers are not moving through the strait unimpeded within the next 24 to 48 hours, we're not going to see negotiations. This is a must-have for Donald Trump because this is a war that went on much longer than he expected. It has had devastating consequences for the global economy. It has undermined his political support, even with his own political base here in the United States, because he said no more forever wars in the Middle East, and I'm going to solve the affordability crisis. Well, guess what? That affordability crisis just got a lot worse because gas is now well over $4 a gallon here. So Trump really can't afford to sit down at the peace table with the Iranians unless oil and gas and fertilizer and helium are flowing through the Gulf. Let's wait and see what happens in the next couple of days.
Charles Kupchan, thanks very much for joining AM.
My pleasure to be with you.
And Dr. Kupchan is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, the fragile ceasefire in the Middle East hasn't deterred the Prime Minister from his mission to secure Australia's fuel supplies with key Asian trading partners. National Affairs correspondent Jane Norman filed this report from Singapore.
Just off the coast of Singapore lies a tiny man-made island that's a global oil trading powerhouse, home to 100 energy companies and three major refineries processing 1.5 million barrels of crude oil a day. But most of that oil typically comes from the Middle East, and Singapore-based sales trader Oriano Lizard told AM the supply shock is rippling through.
For example, Singapore Refining Company, who operates off Jurong Island, they're operating at around 60% capacity due to the shortages. So what it is at the moment is a case of strategic self-sufficiency.
It's a worrying sign for Australia, which imports almost all of its liquid fuels. 80 or so shipments arrive each month. And according to the Australian Institute of Petroleum boss Malcolm Roberts, about half of those are coming from Singapore.
So about 55% of our petrol is from Singapore. So if you like, it's our number one supplier of petrol and a number two supplier of diesel and jet fuel. So that's a pretty formidable volume of fuel coming from Singapore.
Anthony Albanese wants to make sure it stays that way. Later today, he'll fly to Singapore for a one-on-one meeting with Prime Minister Lawrence Wong, a man many countries are courting. Last month, the leaders signed a fuel security agreement to maintain the flow of fuel and LNG between the two countries. Anthony Patton is a Singapore-based energy lawyer and partner at Herbert Smith Freehills. He says it's unlikely the meeting will result in any new supply agreements being signed.
I expect that would have, you know, more sort of soft influence over the producers rather than anything directive. There may be encouragement from the Singaporean side to each of the producers as to the importance of the relationship. There's no specific government or Singapore Inc. involvement in the refineries.
Some countries have started curbing exports. South Korea, Australia's number one supplier of diesel, and China, our top supplier of jet fuel. While Australia's supplies are secure until mid-May, importers are going to extraordinary lengths to get it. Shipments that had normally come from Asia are being sourced from as far away as the UK, the Gulf of Mexico, even Sudan, all adding time and huge costs, according to Malcolm Roberts.
The longer the war goes on, the more refineries in Asia will begin to reduce output, and the greater the risk is that some countries will put in place export restrictions. So we know these problems are building, and if the war continues, then things could sharply turn for the worst. But at the moment, the system's holding up.
For now, hope the ceasefire holds. This is Jane Norman in Singapore reporting for AM.
Iranians in Australia say they're shocked and confused over the latest developments in the Middle East war. Members of the community feel conflicted over wanting political change, but they fear how the US will do it. Catherine Gregory reports.
For Iranian-Australian academic Rana Dadpour, a phone call with a friend in Iran on Tuesday was chilling.
Trying to make sure that there is enough medication in her place, you know, she's keeping enough drinking water. But at the same time, she was telling me that she's so afraid even to go out and buy these basic needs because the regime's checkpoints are in every street. People have been even shot dead in these checkpoints as well.
This conversation happened hours before Donald Trump made his threatening social media post to Iran, saying that a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again, unless Iran agrees to a deal to end the war and unblock the Strait of Hormuz. Civilians in Iran remain on edge.
The messaging is very confusing. It goes from one extreme to another. So one day we have like, okay, help is on the way. We're going to help you to overthrow this regime, which is very well welcomed. But then the next day we have, oh, we're going to destroy this civilization.
The Australian-Iranian Community Alliance represents many Iranians in Australia. Its Vice President, Surin Edgar, says Iranians feel stuck between a rock and a hard place, and in Iran, that could inadvertently help the regime.
When people get worried about the country and about the future, then there is a possibility to push them to stay behind the, you know, Islamic Republic, even if they don't want to do that. So I think these 2 weeks would give time to them to organize the system again.
He says that fear is shared by some in the community.
They worry that the ceasefire may mean that there's going to be a deal broken out with the existing regime, and that there will be just a rebranding of the regime and the IRGC forces, and that they'll still stay in power. So that has caused a lot of anguish and anxiety for people.
Sara Rafi is a lawyer, human rights activist, and is with the Australian Iranian Community Organisation.
It's about whether or not Western governments, they want to remain reactive and be at the mercy of the regime and the IRGC, or West has a choice whether to act proactively to dismantle the regime and the IRGC once and for all.
Iranian-Australian Sara Rafi, ending that report by Catherine Gregory. Artemis II's success in transporting humans further than ever before is not the only exciting space mission Aussies are involved in this year. Researchers from Adelaide are preparing to send cancer cells into the cosmos, hoping to learn more about why cancer spreads, as Annie Guest reports.
In a career dedicated to how cancer progresses and resists treatment, the next step is pivotal for Dr. Nirmal Robinson.
It's highly exciting, definitely, because it's kind of a dream come true for me. But at the same time, yeah, there are nervous moments.
Dr. Robinson is from the Centre for Cancer Biology at Adelaide University, where he's getting ready to send cancer cells into space.
There is a lot of uncertainties and unpredictabilities.
The near weightless microgravity of space creates stress, and the cell's reaction may provide clues as to how some cancer cells spread and resist treatment.
We want everything to be working properly, from the cells that we prepare here, we ship it to Sweden. And in Sweden, again, we grow them for some time. And then, you know, getting everything right in the right containers and payload into the rocket. And hopefully the weather holds up well and the rocket launch goes smoothly.
The project is funded by the South Australian government and supported by partners including space industry consultancy Cambrian Defence and Space. Its CEO, Tiffany Sharp, says they're using a German rocket that's less than 8 metres long.
It looks and sounds just like any other rocket. It's just in a slightly smaller version.
The launch pad is in Swedish territory, from where Tiffany Sharp says rockets have taken off successfully for nearly 60 years.
The launch goes straight up into a parabolic arch, has between 5 and 9 minutes in true microgravity. They then return back to Earth, and we have helicopters launch for sample retrieval and have it back in the hands of our scientists and researchers in under 2 hours.
Once in Dr. Robinson's hands, he'll use a Swedish laboratory to begin processing the samples before continuing investigations back in Adelaide. It's not the first time scientists have examined cancer cells in space, but Dr. Robinson says earlier research hasn't produced a clear result on the impact of near weightlessness.
I'm pretty positive that this could lead to better therapies for people on Earth, and also maybe in the future it might help with the astronauts as well.
Dr. Nirmal Robinson from Adelaide University, ending that report by Annie Guest. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. He was threatening to wipe out a whole civilization. Then, about an hour before his deadline, Donald Trump announced a ceasefire deal had been struck with Iran. They'll now spend the next 2 weeks negotiating a peace plan, but so far it seems like there's little they can agree on. Today, an international affairs expert on what comes next. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.